from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're going to continue in this half hour our election coverage. We'll be talking to veteran reporter and political analyst Mark Sandlow about the national congressional races and how the national picture looks. But if you're just joining us, we had a debate between the two leading candidates in the race for the 3rd Congressional District in California, a race that has national attention because it's an incumbent Republican being challenged by a Democratic challenger, and it's a close race. Ami Barrett being the Democratic challenger, Representative Dan Lundgren, Republican, being the incumbent. There are also three other third-party candidates. As you know, we like to hear from third-party candidates and what they have to say and feel it's an important part of informing citizens. The Peace and Freedom Party candidate, the American Independent Party candidate were not available, but the Libertarian candidate is available and with us, and we're glad to have him. He is running for U.S. Congress 3rd District. He's also chair of the Sacramento Libertarian Party and a retired civil engineer named Art Tooman. Welcome, Art Tooman.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. Well, you didn't hear the debate between candidates Dr. Ami Barrett and Representative Dan Lundgren, but I suppose the obvious question to ask you is, where do you separate yourself from those two, and do you see yourself really as a horse in this race?
Well, yes. A dark horse. It's waiting on the population of America, the voter population, to wake up and see that they have an alternative. They don't have to let Washington spend their taxes for them. Whether they're Democrats or Republicans, that's what happens. Their solutions involve more government spending, taxpayer money. And the alternative to that, of course, is less government spending of taxpayer money. And that's where the Libertarian Party comes. We liberate taxpayers from government slavery.
Where else do you differ from the candidates? I mean, you're presenting sort of, forgive me for phrasing it such, but, you know, standard libertarian position here when you talk about not taxing and not having government interfere. Where, for example, are you on the wars that we talked about with both candidates in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, libertarians are kind of over the policy map on foreign involvement.
Where's Art Tooman?
Art Tooman, he recognizes enemies and threatening enemies when they tell us they're going to attack us. And we should believe them. And we should take steps to defend America. And that's what we've been doing in the last decade. And I'm sorry that much of America has found it fashionable to say, oh, we've got no excuse to be over there, just bring them all home. That's just absolutely not true. We have definite threats worldwide, right here in America, as part of a global attack against the freedoms that America stands for. And when America falls, that's the last bastion against freedom.
Talking to Art Tooman, Libertarian candidate for U.S. Congress in the 3rd District, I had said when I introduced the two major candidates, Representative Lundgren and Dr. Ami Barrett, that they were on different sides on the tax cuts, on offshore oil drilling, and on gay marriage. And let's find out where you are. First of all, with the Bush tax cuts, you would want to extend them or not?
Well, yes, I see no reason at all to ever increase taxes. And when you're talking about stopping or reversing tax cuts, that's what you're doing. You're increasing taxes. So I think the Bush tax cuts were a good thing for the country. Anytime people are allowed to spend money as they choose, it gets spent better. It gets spent more wisely. And America as a whole prospers more than it would if bureaucrats were to spend that money.
And what about offshore oil drilling?
Well, offshore oil drilling is an issue that involves holding property away from development, and libertarians are not for withholding property from development. In fact, the reason why we would like to see property owned by private owners instead of the government, and that's the problem with offshore drilling leases, they're owned by the government. If they're owned by private holders, then they would get developed. As soon as private holders thought it was reasonably rational to develop those properties.
And finally, if you would, you as a libertarian, stand where on gay marriage?
Well, gay marriage is a strange concept to me. I never saw a marriage that turned out very gay. But I don't see any reason why the government should interfere with the relationship between two people or more. So I would like to see government get out of the marriage issue. There's nothing in the Constitution about marriage, and I intend to keep it that way.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I wish you good luck in your campaign. And Artum, again, is a Libertarian candidate for the United States Congress, 3rd District, chair of the Sacramento Libertarian Party, retired and civil engineer. Thank you, Mr. Tuma.
Thank you.
We're going to go now to Washington and welcome Mark Sandelow, who, of course, teaches politics and journalism at the University of California's Washington Center, mainly known, of course, here in San Francisco as our former Washington bureau chief for the San Francisco Chronicle and author of a book about Nancy Pelosi, Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi's Lifetimes and Rise to Power. And welcome, Mark Sandelow.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Well, the common wisdom seems to be that... I'm not trying to jinx it or influence it or anything, but that we're going to probably have a shift in the House and that Madam Speaker will not hold her position.
Yeah, you can always tell the side that feels it might lose, the one that says it's an outrage that the media relies on polls, that you know the only count that matters is the one that happens on Election Day. You know, that's something that people who are going down to defeat typically say, and right now that certainly looks that way for Democrats. I mean, let me give you a quick math in the House. There are 435 members, roughly 100 seats right now are considered in play. And I don't pretend to have gone out and surveyed these myself, but there are a handful of experts who go out and either conduct polling or gather the polling from every district. And all of them, whether it's Charlie Cook or Stu Rothenberg or Larry Sabato, these people who track district by district, say there's about 100 districts in play, and here's the problem for Democrats. They could win a number of these districts, but of the 100 districts that have the potential to either side to win, about 90% of them, 90 of them, are held by Democrats right now. So even if Democrats win half of those, they're talking about losing, you know, 40, 45 seats in the next Congress. The majority right now is plus 39 for Democrats. It's a very important number. That what that means is if Democrats, you know, lose 38 seats, Nancy Pelosi, unless some other things happen, would remain Speaker of the House. If they lose 40 seats, she's replaced by John Boehner of Ohio. And the consequences, I mean, we can talk about the big picture, but just in terms of what it means, like even locally in the Bay Area, I mean, the difference between the Republicans picking up 39 and 40 seats is the difference between George Miller chairing the Labor and Health Subcommittee, the Education Committee in the House, and having a conservative who opposes the health care reforms chairing it. It means, you know, replacing Zoe Lofgren as chairing an immigration panel. She's very much in favor of immigration reform that would lead to a path to citizenship, with a Republican who very, very much opposes anything that would grant any undocumented residents any sort of amnesty. So the policy consequences are rather large from the shift in committees, even if the ultimate result is likely to be a lot of gridlock, as some people have complained it has been for the last couple of years.
It's rather, I mean, this is a pretty kind of crazy election. So many have commented on how odd it is, you know, particularly with some of the Tea Party candidates being, shall we say, eccentric
and nutty,
off the grid of what we're used to in terms of campaigns that can be crazy enough ordinarily. But, you know, you get witches and things like that. But here in California, we seem to have kind of a reversal in some ways. We just had the first debate between Ami Bera and Dan Lundgren. And here you have a Republican trying to keep his seat, sort of the reverse of what we've seen elsewhere. And it almost appears as if a lot of the steam that's come from the Tea Party, if you will, hasn't wafted out here to California as much as one might expect.
And Michael, it either speaks to your great success or your great failings as a debate moderator, that in the last 24 hours, there have been one debate where a supposed supporter of one candidate had their head stomped on the sidewalk, captured in videotape. That was in Kentucky, where a MoveOn.org protester was sort of beat up by Rand Paul's supporters. There was another debate in Florida where the between the governor candidates, where the Democrat was accused and fessed up to getting a phone call during a commercial break from her makeup artist, who passed on notes from her campaign manager, which was she was then accused on air by the Republican of cheating during the debate, immediately fired her aide. So the fact that you conducted somewhat of a civil debate between the candidates in that district, like I say, speaks to either your success or your failings there as a moderator. It has been a nutty season. You know, you have the witchcraft. I mean, Google Aqua Buddha, and you will see more than you ever want to read about the Kentucky Senate race. But let me just put another way of looking at this in context, because, you know, in the media, we always love to look at, I mean, it's a lot more interesting to talk about an ad that says, I am not a witch, than it is to get into, say, the Rhode Island budget process and who's going to win the Rhode Island race.
Or it's more interesting, excuse me, Mark, to hear about a Rhode Island candidate telling President Obama to shove it than to talk about the budget matter specifically.
You're right. Here I am reaching for a sober example of Rhode Island, and even that's not sober. But this is kind of interesting. You think about how the media is portraying this. Most people understand that this has a potential to be an enormous wave election, a shift election, big changes. But if you look back at the last couple of elections, in 2006, Democrats picked up about 30 seats. In 2008, they picked up another 21. Democrats have picked up 54 seats in the last two election cycles. That's why Nancy Pelosi is Speaker. That's why Democrats have a majority in the House. What most of the district-by-district predictors are saying is that Republicans are going to pick up somewhere between 45 and 60 seats. What that means is, if they are right, we are going to be exactly where we were 4 years ago. And that is not a wild shift. That is a subtle shift of districts like the Lundgren district shifting maybe just a little bit, or the district, the McNerney district, which is down by Pleasanton and little beyond into Stockton. That it's a district where Democrats took it from the Republicans 4 years ago, and not by a landslide, but they won by several percentage points. And now the Republican has the possibility of knocking off the Democrat by several percentage points. That's not a huge shift to the American public necessarily. It's a huge shift in the majority of Congress. And sometimes people get caught up on how the nation is, lunging.
Well, excuse me, there are bigger shifts outside of California, aren't there? There are more dramatic shifts than the ones you just noted outside of California. That was my point about how California almost seems in a kind of separate category.
And I guess my point, Michael, is that nationwide, if the Republican landslide occurs that everyone is predicting, the House of Representatives will be just about exactly where it was 4 years ago. And so that these, of course, there are going to be a lot more Republicans, and the question is how many. But the shift is not as dramatic as the media point out. Your point about California being different is well taken, in that while the rest of the country appears to move to the Republican Party, Democrats at least stand a chance of, taking over a Republican governor's seat and winning in the Senate. And Democrats could indeed have, if Dan Lundgren were to lose, they would actually pick up a House seat. So you may again see the headlines, which we've seen a lot over the last few decades, which is California is different than the rest of the country.
Well, it brings up the whole question of polling and how much we really know from the polling. You know, it keeps striking me, and I'm sure you as well, that people get called, but young people don't get called because they all have cell phones and they're not necessarily participating in the polling. And so the whole idea of how young people are going to vote, particularly many of those who turned out for President Obama, who would make a difference for the Democrats, we don't really know. We're really kind of navigating in the dark here in every sense, aren't we?
Not in every sense. Some polls are good and some polls are bad. But if you took a look, for example, in 2008 at the predictions of what President Obama was going to win by, they were remarkably accurate. Some of them were off by 2 or 3 percentage points, but most of them were closer than that. The reason the candidates spend millions of dollars on polling is because generally they're effective. Now, you do make a point that the changing nature of, cell phones, and people don't want to talk on the phones. I don't know about you, but I would caller ID. I don't answer three quarters of my phone calls anyways, that it changes the reliability of polls, and those pollsters who don't make good adjustments are out of business, and they tend to work. Now there's also an interesting difference. When you go district by district, it's a little harder to get a random sample. It's one thing to poll the whole state of California and find out who's ahead, Whitman or Brown, or whether the state will cast its electoral votes for the Democrat or Republican. But if you're going into the 11th congressional district in California and asking McNerney or Harmer, who, you know, possibly, you know, a good percentage of the people probably never heard of either one of them, but polling tends to be less reliable. That said, the pollsters, their credibility and their livelihood is on the line. And if they take a bath in this election, then people are going to find other pollsters and they're out of work.
We're talking to Mark Sandelow, and let me open the phone lines. I know there are many of you who have questions about this election. We're talking really about the congressional races and how things look nationally, and you are certainly free to join us with any questions or comments you might have. Toll-free number is yours. It's 866-733-6786, and again, we welcome your phone calls, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Feel free to join the program now, 866-733-6786, or send us an email. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And here's a comment from a listener named Steve who says, we're likely to be told in the next couple of weeks that another landslide national election happened. What really is occurring is that 50 congressional districts are in play. These represent fewer than 4 million Americans, 750,000 districts. These capricious districts seem to have a stranglehold on our national debate. We are told that they are representative of the mood and realities in the rest of the nation. Is this true? Many would say no.
Well, I agree with everything that every comment he makes there, except for maybe the word capricious. They're not necessarily sample districts. They don't necessarily represent everybody, but it doesn't make them capricious because what they are the swing districts. And, I mean, it's true for any close battle that, you know, the extremes you take for granted, and then the middle is where you tend to pay the attention. That's where the difference is going to be made up. So the fact that there are some places down near Bakersfield that always vote Republican, and that San Francisco, no matter how popular or unpopular Nancy Pelosi may be around the country, is certainly going to vote Democratic for the, you know, for as long as I can imagine. That doesn't mean that it's capricious of a district composed of some of the people with values from southern inland places like Bakersfield and some people with Bay Area values, who, by the way, meet in that 11th district I was talking about around Stockton, aren't going to be the focus. It's totally reasonable that they would be the focus because that's where the difference is going to be. And what I agree with most of his comments in that, I mean, let's say that there's a turnover of 50 seats, and that is called a landslide election. So 50 out of 450, which is how many members, 435 there are in the House, we're talking about roughly one-seventh of the House turning over. That means, you know, we're talking over 90% of incumbents who are winning re-election. And American politics and American policy move slowly. And while the media likes a big landslide story, it isn't always that way. And it's been very frustrating, I think, to members of the left the last couple of years to see them at a high watermark with Democrats in control of both chambers of Congress and the White House and still not be able to get, you know, health care with a public option, a basic global warming bill.
Closing up Guantanamo and getting Don't Ask, Don't Tell thrown out. Actually, it keeps occurring to me, though, that this is a blue state, and it's all about turnout, really, in California. And in that sense, California may be off the grid as well. And what I mentioned before about the polling and how mysterious it can be in terms of what we don't know. I'm looking at an email from a listener named Jenny up in Napa who says, I find it hard to believe any announcement on how the elections are likely to turn out for a few reasons. Many of my friends are 20 to 30-something who have a propensity for procrastination, wait until November 2nd to vote, including me. Also, I have been a registered voter since the age of 18, and I have never been polled. Are pollsters using landlines for the most part? None of my friends or colleagues have landlines, and most of us have private cell phone numbers. So there it is again. Let me get our callers on here, though, and we go first to a caller in Morristown, New Jersey. Bob, join us. Hi.
Thank you. Just a question and a comment. The polls in the Republican primaries, particularly in Alaska, which had Miller down by something like 27 points 3 weeks before the election, and what's her name, the lady in the pointed hat in Delaware?
Christine O'Donnell.
Yeah, indeed. All these polls were way off in a lot of the Tea Party races. You know, Sharon Angle out in Nevada was indicated she was a loser, and not by, you know, small margin of error percentages. So again, it raises the question: how reliable are these things?
You want to comment, Mark?
Well, I mean, these ones in particular, we're going to know in 7 days, 8 days. I guess in 8 days we'll know the results. But I can tell you that as easy it is to come up with reasons why polls shouldn't work, they would not still be used as they are if they were as ineffective as people think they are. And I mean, the caller points out something real important. He's right that the polls can be off in part because of people's enthusiasm levels. I mean, if we had Australian law in the United States that forced everyone to vote upon penalty of a fine, Democrats would probably do quite well, as more people say they like Democrats even now than like Republicans. But that's simply not, when pollsters go out to try to find those people who are most motivated to vote right now, they tend to find that Republicans are doing much better now. The caller points out, why should a pollster necessarily know whether or not you're going to show up to vote next week when you haven't even decided yourself? Well, the short answer to that is they have years of experience at looking at these things. Some pollsters look at past voting records, and to be cruel here for a second, they'll take somebody like Jerry Brown, who votes every year, and he's a likely voter. Then they'll take a Christine Whitman, who hasn't voted. Meg Whitman, who has not voted every time, and they'll say, ah, she's a maybe voter, and they'll look at somebody who hasn't voted at all and say they're probably not going to show up, and when they poll these people, they put them in different categories. I always thought it would be fun, especially as somebody who used to write about election results, I used to advise people, when you see an exit pollster, lie to them. Lie to the exit pollster, because it makes it a lot more fun for us if the polls are wrong, because then you actually have to listen to the results the next day, which keeps news people employed. Upsets happen. Truman did defeat Dewey. That said, the polls are overwhelmingly correct. And let me just actually, on the other side of this, let me just prepare you already for what you'll hear if Democrats surprise the pundits and actually prevail next week. What you'll hear is the polls are only a snapshot of a certain moment of history. Had the election been held last week when we did our polling, Republicans would have won. But there must have been a surge in the last week for the Democrats.
The other thing that's fascinating in difference and different in this election is the GOP has made some real strides as far as using this social media. I don't know what kind of impact that's going to have, but it may be another mysterious force in what's being predicted or not predicted. And I've got a listener here named Bill who says the big difference in California is that the legislature gerrymandered the electoral districts so that incumbents of both parties have a huge advantage. That's why so few congressional seats in the state are in play. On the other hand, Joseph Biden said he's never seen so many races in play here. And we've got, we haven't even mentioned 37 gubernatorial races. It's a big election.
No, you know what? I think Biden's comment proves your listener's point. Biden has never seen a congressional election with so many seats in play. So the wild outside speculation of how many seats are in play is 100. That's less than a quarter of the House of Representatives. So when 75% of the House districts aren't even in play, and you have longtime politicians like Biden saying, whoa, that's the most districts I've ever seen, I think it proves the caller's point that, yes, legislators and politicians tend to draw districts that protect incumbents. And, you know, that issue is on the California ballot. If you can decipher the difference between, what is it, Prop 23 and 27, 20 and 27, then that may well change the way that districts are drawn in California.
Let me go to more of your calls, and we'll go to Michael in Greenbrae. Good morning.
Yes, my question is about if we the people are supposed to be the beneficiaries of our politicians getting into office, what is the benefit of the polls for us? And what is the benefit of exit polls for us? All it seems to do is skew, as it comes across the news, the thinking of the people out there who may not be in a position to have all the news or the facts or whatever. And so they say, well, gee, maybe I want to be on the winning side because it's going this direction or something. Do you have any comments on that?
Mark Sandler?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question, because I think you have a real point that what value is it to, you know, for NBC to be able to report 3.5 minutes before CBS who's going to take control of the House? And by the same virtue, what is the difference does it make that, you know, that the San Francisco Chronicle is able to report 2 weeks before the election who is likely to win? I mean, is there a civic value or is there an entertainment value? And I think that most of the reason polls are done is because they show dramatic shifts one way or the other that the news media assumes, and I think rightly so a lot of the times, will draw in readers and listeners. It's interesting to hear about a surge, which is why you never hear a headline that says polls remain the same. You know, one side's moving up, one side is moving down, and if a poll showed that the status quo was remaining, that story wouldn't go on the front page of the newspaper. It would be buried.
Well, it becomes a horse. It's a horse race, isn't it?
What would happen? Why would the public lose if there weren't polls? I don't think the public would lose. The politicians would lose because they would have a harder time figuring out who they need to appeal to win office. But then the question, I mean, remember, the media doesn't exist out there because it's good for you. The media exists out there because, it's a private business. And people, except for public radio stations and a few other outlets, you know, tend to be in this because at some level they want to make money. It's not that the reporters or the editors could care less about whether or not, you know, their publishers are making money necessarily. And then maybe why I don't work at the San Francisco Chronicle anymore, by the way. But the caller has a point. If we were doing this purely as a matter of civic good, what value is there in predicting? I do see a value in trying to figure out which ethnic groups or which age groups or which education levels voted for what types of people, because I find it fascinating and it's probably interesting in terms of getting candidates to address the people's needs in a democracy where not everyone can express their needs. But why it is that every day, if you Google the 2010 elections, 90% of the stories you get will be about polls and not about policy, and that's probably not a good thing.
We've got seconds left. You want to go on record with any predictions here in California?
No, after this, I think all I can tell you is, and this is where I differ from a lot of the callers, polls do tend to work. The polls suggest that Republicans are going to have a great Tuesday next week, and the Democrats are going to do quite well in California. And my guess is you'll be seeing a lot of analysis a week from now about why California, once again, is different from the rest of the country.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us. That's Mark Sandler with us from Washington, and again, the author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi's Life, former Washington bureau chief for the San Francisco Chronicle. Another hour coming your way, and in the hour ahead, we're going to talk about the Giants and the World Series. Join us for that. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.